Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
I was wearing the wrong foundation shade for years, and no one told me. Thanks, guys. Then I discovered Il Makiage, the bold new beauty brand using AI to shade match. Their best-selling Woke Up Like This foundation has 50,000 five-star reviews and is a total game-changer for my glow-up. Plus, it's cruelty-free. You can even try before you buy at home for 14 days, risk-free. Take the quiz and get your shade of flawless at ilmakiage.com/quiz. That's ilmakiage.com/quiz.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and in the early hours of Monday, the 29th of June, these are our main stories. President Trump has been condemned for retweeting a video of one of his supporters shouting "White Power." President Macron's party has failed to make a significant impression in France's delayed local elections. The national incumbent has topped the polls in Poland's presidential election, but has failed to win outright. Also in this podcast, we'll hear from an emergency doctor in Arizona, where hospitals and staff are said to be at breaking point from COVID-19.
We are having an increased number of patients who are very sick, who are scared. They're struggling to breathe. We might be the last people they ever see.
And
the untypical exhibitionism of these athletes also violates the basic standards of sportsmanship and good manners.
One of the athletes who did the Black Power salute at the 1968 Olympics calls for protests to be allowed. President Trump has provoked a furious row in the United States after he retweeted a video showing one of his supporters shouting "White Power." The video shows a man in a golf cart with Trump campaign posters and other supporters being confronted by protesters, yelling profanities, calling them racists and Nazis. The president's retweet thanks what he calls the great people of the villages the Florida retirement community filmed in the clip. I asked our US correspondent, Peter Bowes, why the president feels the need to get involved in such incidents.
The president's motives are clearly debatable, and we've had a statement from the White House which says that the president didn't see the one statement that was made on the video, clearly the white power, the offensive statement to so many. But the statement from the White House added that Mr. Trump did see tremendous enthusiasm from his many supporters. So that would be, at least on the face of it, his justification for sending out or retweeting this video, that it represents his supporters, in this case, people in a retirement home called The Villages in Florida that he visited a year ago. He sees them supporting him. They had banners, Trump 2020 and America First. But of course, many others are offended by the content of that video using a phrase used by white supremacists.
Is it credible, though, to suggest that he wouldn't have seen it if he watched the video? Because it's 10 seconds in and it's pretty... The man who says it is right in the middle of the screen.
It is pretty clear, and it is full of, as you suggest, very offensive language. And you would have thought anyone with any kind of radar in terms of what to publish and what not to publish via Twitter, something that might be offensive to people, you would have thought people would spot that, or indeed the president would spot that. He says, or at least his people at the White House say, he didn't spot it. So we're left to interpret what the motive was. Was it to stir the pot? Was it to inflame people? Was it to do what others have accused the president of doing in the past? And that is get in the middle of racial tensions. And there are plenty of examples, of course, going back to Charlottesville in 2017, when we remember that there was violence between President Trump's supporters and neo-Nazis. It was a violent situation. Afterwards, President Trump said that there were very fine people on both sides.
The only African-American Republican Senator, Tim Scott, described the tweet as offensive and called on the president to remove it. The tweet has now gone from his Twitter feed. What are we to make of that?
Well, it clearly someone has got to the president. I assume that others have control of that Twitter feed as well. So whether it was the president who hit delete or someone else at the White House, we really don't know. It's certainly rare for things to disappear. And it's even rarer for President Trump to apologize or acknowledge that he made a mistake. Now, he hasn't done that in this case, but the tweet did stay there for about 3 hours mid-morning US East Coast time. After widespread criticism, Alex Azar, his health secretary, was on television to be interviewed about other matters, but he was asked whether he had seen the footage. He said he hadn't, but he said that he in fact insisted that the president and the administration wouldn't do anything to be supportive of white supremacy.
Peter Bowes. The killing of George Floyd and the rise of the Black Lives Matter movement in the United States has forced many other countries to confront racism and police brutality. Authorities in the Indian state of Tamil Nadu have ordered a federal investigation into the deaths of two men whose treatment by police has sparked a national outcry, and they've suspended a third police officer in the case. Across India, there's growing anger about police using beatings to enforce lockdowns and the systemic discrimination of the minority Muslim population. This report from our South Asia correspondent, Rajini Vaidyanathan.
In the South Indian town of Sakantulam, hundreds gathered for the funeral of two men. Crowds lined the streets to say goodbye to father and son, Jayaraj and Benix. Last week, police officers turned up to the mobile phone shop they ran and arrested the men, claiming they'd violated an 8 p.m. coronavirus curfew. They were taken to the station. Benix's sister Persis says her brother and father were tortured there.
At the station, so many police officers hit him. My brother was so badly beaten, he was unrecognizable. I saw the photo of my dead brother's body. His chest hair had been pulled out. He was covered in blood. They beat him brutally.
The police told the BBC Tamil service that Jayaraj had died of fever and Benrix of chest pain, a charge the family dispute. Two officers have been suspended, others have been transferred, but no arrests have been made. A report by the National Campaign Against Torture in India said this week that in 2019 alone, there were around 5 custodial deaths a day in India.
Hi, I'm Suchitra. I'm South Indian and I hate how every South Indian issue becomes just a South Indian issue because we don't talk about it in English.
Suchitra Mitra, a local radio host from the area, posted a video which attracted more than 1 million views on Twitter.
This case cannot close like this. Please do not let it close. Unless and until we get the same justice George Floyd's murderers did.
But in India, police violence doesn't trigger mass outrage like it has in America. The story of Jayaraj and Benix isn't an isolated one. During India's strict coronavirus lockdown, police used heavy-handed tactics to ensure people stayed inside. Videos beating people to the ground with sticks, or lathis as they're known, were regularly shared on social media and WhatsApp. It took the brutal death of George Floyd to spark change in America. What will it take for India to do the same?
Rajini Vaidyanathan. The number of confirmed cases of coronavirus across the globe has passed the 10 million mark, and there are further signs of a resurgence of cases in the US. Meanwhile, the World Health Organization is warning that in many countries, the pandemic still hasn't peaked. Terry Egan has this report.
Arizona, Florida, and now California, where the governor has ordered some bars to close again. There's a new surge of cases in the US, and it's just underlining the force and speed of this global pandemic. In the first month of the outbreak, near the beginning of the year, fewer than 10,000 cases were reported worldwide. In the last month alone, there were almost 4 million, and more than 1 million have been added just since June the 21st. Governments are getting a lot of blame. Nancy Pelosi on ABC referring pointedly to President Trump's approach.
Wearing masks, washing your hands, there is a way to do it. Instead of what the administration did, deny, delay, death, it's time for this administration to take this seriously.
But what of deaths? Again, we're talking about the speed of increase. As it stands, there are nearly 500,000, and in familiar locations. Again, around a quarter of those in the US, and now more than 100,000 in Latin America. Is it the start of a second wave? The World Health Organization, of course, has tried to organize a global response to a global pandemic, but it hasn't been easy. Perhaps we just haven't adapted to the new normal. With huge pressure on the world economy, some countries are chafing at the measures needed to combat the pandemic. Although many, such as Thailand and China, have effective track and trace measures in operation, and some quickly instituted quarantines, others are perhaps, to put it kindly, placing most of their faith in the emergence of a vaccine. But even if one comes, it will do so into a changed world. Not only has the pandemic demonstrated how vulnerable the globalized world is, but we've also been forced to rethink what we know of as daily life, from how we treat each other to general hygiene. Things we took for granted we might never see in the same light again, frequent flying, for instance, or over-reliance on vehicles. Just this weekend, a report came out about how air pollution helps spread the disease. With weddings and funerals cut in size or put on hold, our social lives may never be the same again. And with home working on the increase for those lucky enough to still have jobs, the same is true for our economic lives too.
Well, as we heard there in Terry's report, a quarter of the confirmed cases of COVID-19 are in the US. The surge of cases is particularly acute in several southern and western states. In Arizona, record numbers of new cases are being reported every day, and hospitals and staff are said to be at breaking point. BBC's James Menendez got more from one ER doctor in Tucson, Bradley Dreyfus.
We are having an increased number of patients who are coming in who are very sick with strokes and respiratory failure, who are scared. They're struggling to breathe. We're having to put them on a ventilator. We might be the last people they ever see. Their families aren't next to them because there are no visitors. And it's exceptionally stressful for all of us. And when you have high levels of stress, you have less capacity for compassion because you can only maintain this for so long. When you have increased numbers of patients with COVID who are sitting in the emergency department because the wards, the COVID wards and the ICUs are full, that means you have less beds available to see patients who are coming in from car crashes or have appendicitis or having a heart attack or a stroke or a gallbladder attack. People are waiting in the waiting room with all of this and sicker and sicker. We are parents. We are spouses. We are family members. We are members of the community as well. We're human. That means that we're going to have to actually consider what the risks and benefits are to us and our family. It's, again, why I'm living it away from home for the last 2.5, almost 3 months.
I mean, are the wards at your hospital in Tucson, I mean, are they at breaking point, would you say, at the moment?
Absolutely. I just got off the phone with a colleague who is a hospitalist working up in Scottsdale, and their COVID wards are full. Ours are full. There's nowhere else to put patients. Patients are being transferred around the state and sitting in the emergency department because the wards are full. People are being managed as best we can without ventilators. We're coming to the point where we're going to have to be rationing ventilators. What do you say to a 55-year-old when you have no more ventilators left and they're looking death in the eye and scared and struggling to breathe? That's emotionally devastating for the patients, for the families, for the healthcare teams. It should absolutely be noted that our extended care facilities, our long-term care facilities, where our elders live, are being devastated. It is an absolute calling of our elder population.
So you haven't seen your family for 2.5 months. You're working constant nights, and as you say, many nights in a row sometimes. I mean, how are you managing to keep body and, more importantly, soul together?
I think just like folks in the military, those of us on the front lines of healthcare, when we're working in acute situations, we put all of that off. We essentially steel ourselves. The psychological effect on healthcare workers and our community at large is going to be devastating, and increased risks of suicide, major depression, lost time at work, or like soldiers in a battlefield where you're able to compartmentalize. And it's when the first wave finishes that we really process and it hits us. And we don't have the people initially rallying around us because everyone will be emotionally exhausted. Everyone is already emotionally exhausted. And so that's when the real psychological trauma comes in. And that's an absolutely terrifying proposition because there's plenty of data to show that it's that 2, 3, 4 month period. And that's exactly when we're projecting to have this massive tsunami of COVID and influenza.
So a second wave possibly combined with seasonal flu.
Yes. And that we project to be in October, November, and last through the winter. And it is going to break our healthcare systems. It's going to break our society.
ER Dr. Bradley Dreyfus in Tucson, Arizona. You're listening to the Global News Podcast on the BBC World Service. Still to come, one of Italy's greatest collections of Renaissance masterpieces ventures onto TikTok. One other thing, we, that is the Global News Podcast team, have been nominated for an award. It's the Listener's Choice Gong at the British Podcast Awards. It really would mean a great deal to me, Emilio, Jackie, Nick, Oliver and Val, and the many members of the team you don't hear, if you could take a minute to support us. We're up against some stiff competition. The web address is britishpodcastawards.com/vote. If you've done it already, I've been mentioning this for a couple of days, how about introducing a friend to the podcast and then persuading them to vote for us too? My sincere thanks in advance. As we record this podcast, the party of the French President Emmanuel Macron appears to have failed to make significant gains in the second round of local elections. Turnout in a vote delayed by the pandemic was very low. Hugh Schofield reports.
The Green Party seems to have confirmed its good showing in round one, taking towns like Poitiers and Besançon, and clearly wants to position itself now as France's main party of the left. The socialist Anne Hidalgo looks certain to hold on to the mayorship of Paris, where her campaign focused strongly on environmental issues. There was no breakthrough for President Macron's La République En Marche, confirming the party's difficulties in forming a grassroots base to rival those of the traditional parties.
Hugh Schofield. Polish people have been voting in a delayed presidential election that was due to take place last month. President Andrzej Duda is an ally of the governing Law and Justice Party, and if he loses, the opposition could force big changes in Polish politics. Will it? A question for Adam Easton in Warsaw.
We've had the first exit poll immediately, which shows that the incumbent, President Andrzej Duda, has won the most votes, 41.8%, but that is not enough to win outright in the first round. None of the 11 candidates got the required 50% plus one vote, which would be enough to win in the first round. So it looks like if this exit poll is confirmed by the official results, which we're not going to get until perhaps on Tuesday because of the coronavirus, that President Andrzej Duda will be in a runoff in 2 weeks' time with the second placed candidate, the Liberal Mayor of Warsaw, Rafał Trzaskowski, who, according to this exit poll, trailed by 11 percentage points. He got about just over 30%.
The coronavirus was quite a big factor in this election, wasn't it?
The coronavirus played a very large factor in the election that didn't happen, that was cancelled in May. It was supposed to take place in May. The government were desperate to get that election held, and they tried to enact legislation which would have led to an unprecedented postal-only vote during the middle of the pandemic. Now, the government failed to do that, essentially, and the election was null and void. And it was called again, which allowed the opposition to actually field a new candidate, Mr. Trzaskowski, who's performed much, much better than his predecessor, Małgorzata Kidawa-Błońska, who was trailing very much in the polls behind Mr. Duda.
If it is a runoff, as expected, between the president and the mayor of Warsaw, this is a real clash of values, isn't it?
Very much. Mr. Duda reflects social conservatism, patriotism, defending traditional Roman Catholic values and defending what it calls traditional families. This was a feature of the campaign. President Duda made some comments which were criticised widely both here and in the EU, saying that LGBTQ was an ideology, not a group of people. Mr. Trzaskowski is much more liberal. As Warsaw City Mayor, he introduced what was called an LGBT card, which was basically to defend equal rights for all people. This election by the government-supporting media was basically saying this is a vote for a red and white president, red and white of the Polish flag, or a rainbow president. That's how they portrayed this race.
Adam Easton in Warsaw. It was a historic moment captured by the world's media. Now, one of the two American sprinters who gave the Black Power salute at the 1968 Mexico Olympics, John Carlos, has led calls for the scrapping of a rule which forbids athletes from protesting. Carlos, who's now 75, has signed a letter with current US athletes. Daniel Mann has this report.
The time in Mexico, 2 a.m. In Britain, it's 9 a.m. Good morning to you. Tommy Smith and John Carlos give the Black Power salute as they receive their medals after the 200 metres final.
By the time of the Mexico Olympics in October 1968, and just 6 months after the assassination of Martin Luther King, the civil rights movement was at fever pitch. What better place to take a courageous stand than in front of a global audience? The US sprinter Tommy Smith won gold in the 200 metres, and his fellow African-American John Carlos took bronze. When they went to the podium to collect their medals, they shocked the world. In a cry for freedom and racial justice, they each raised an arm in the air, both of them with a fist clenched and each of them wearing a black glove, a symbol of Black America. For doing this and bowing their heads during the Star-Spangled Banner, their national anthem, they were expelled from the Games.
The untypical exhibitionism of these athletes also violates the basic standards of sportsmanship and good manners, which are so highly regarded in the United States.
Rule 50 of the Olympic Charter bans political protests, but John Carlos is now pressing for its abolition so that athletes can bring about change. In a letter to the International Olympic Committee, he writes, "Athletes will no longer be silenced. We are now at a crossroads. The IOC and the International Paralympic Committee cannot continue on the path of punishing or removing athletes who speak up for what they believe in, especially when those beliefs exemplify the goals of Olympism. The committee has promised to consult with athletes so they can express support for the principles enshrined in the Olympic Charter in a dignified way. But other sports federations, including football's world governing body FIFA, the International Cricket Council and the National Football League in the US, have softened their position in this area. And with the Black Lives Matter movement calling for widespread change following the killing of George Floyd, the pressure on the IOC is expected to intensify in the run-up to the Tokyo Olympics next year.
Daniel Mann. The Uffizi Gallery in Florence in Italy is one of the world's great museums and pretty traditional, but it's been finding a new audience during lockdown, young people, on the social media platform TikTok. Tens of thousands have liked its video creations, using some of the museum's best-known paintings in an irreverent, occasionally risque, way. The Uffizi's Ilde Forgione told the BBC's James Menendez just how they're bringing old works to a new medium.
The Morgante dwarf was one of the dwarfs that were in the Medici's court, and the dwarfs, they played a very important role in the court, such as jesters or sometimes nannies for the children. And Morgante was the favorite one of Cosimo, that was painted by Bronzino in a curious double portrait, representing him as a bird hunter. So we used this historical fact to make Morgante go hunting in Boboli's garden nowadays. And we linked it to a very popular music on the TikTok and on the radio.
What about Botticelli Spring, a masterpiece, very well known, with Venus mm-hmm. as the main character? I mean, what you've done to that one, I mean, some would say it's quite offensive.
We did two about the spring. One is the relation to the COVID, and we just imagine what would happen if the garden scene would have take place during the pandemic. So we imagine Venus arriving in the garden, seeing the other characters too close, and screaming at them, asking the respect for distancing, I think is not offensive.
I was thinking about the one that was set to the club track where it goes nails, hair, hips, heels, okay. And then it focuses on each part of her body.
Legs, face, eyes, thin waist, thick thighs.
I mean, some might balk at that.
Oh, well, if you think body is offensive, but we don't think body
No, but there are quite rude words in the song, aren't there?
Oh, we think we can get art to be ironic. So if you use in a humoristic language, you are self-ironic, you cannot be offensive.
Are there some of your colleagues in the museum, perhaps some of the older colleagues, who think what you're doing is somehow demeaning the art?
Oh, well, you just can't please everyone.
And have you been surprised by how many people have liked these videos?
Yes, we are, but we are pleased of it because it means that we are going a good job. We are going to evolve, of course. We're going to experiment. We're going to try things. But I think what we are doing is brand new and is innovative. And so we must continue study, analyzing, and discuss about the way to communicate. So you have to be in the places where people is and try to speak their language in order to pass your mission. To get people close to art.
Ilde Forgione from the Uffizi Gallery. Let's return to the coronavirus pandemic. It's made learning, remote learning, particularly hard for children with developmental difficulties such as autism. And it's added to the strain for families who are now caring full-time for their children. New York City has more than 300,000 students who receive special educational services. Laura Trevelyan reports on how parents and their children are coping.
Where are we going, Jack, on Friday?
Minnesota.
Close. Remember, should I show you how to spell it again? Look.
Jack and his mother, Laurie, are getting ready for a road trip after being stuck at home in Brooklyn since March.
If we continue staying home as is, the same way, are you going to like that?
Yeah, no.
No.
Jack has autism, and this gregarious 17-year-old misses the routine of the classroom in this strange era of coronavirus.
His school is his community. It's, you know, his extended family. And they hold Jack accountable,
yeah.
Which he sometimes doesn't like most teenagers. But Jack misses them, and he misses seeing his friends, his classmates.
Is that the hardest aspect for Jack, the social isolation?
Yeah.
Yeah, 100%.
Summer camps for children with developmental disabilities enable kids to get together and give their families a respite from being full-time carers. Even though New York's governor has just said these camps can open, it's not straightforward. Caitlin Cassaro, the mother of two disabled children herself, runs free programming for low-income families, but she's not sure she can do it this summer.
If we opened up, how am I going to wear a mask all day and keep 6 feet away from children, keep children away from each other, especially children with different needs who may not even understand what's happening right now? It's just not a reality.
The coronavirus outbreak has been disruptive for student schooling across America. But for the 7 million children who receive special education services, it's a crisis within a crisis. Vulnerable young people who've worked so hard to make progress now risk losing ground.
Dolly, Dolly,
da, da, da.
Children with significant special needs have difficulty engaging in remote learning and they have difficulty participating.
Christine Jenner runs a speech therapy program in Brooklyn and she's been forced to stop providing services to half her children, all of them low income. That's because New York City's Department of Education, which is reeling from the impact of coronavirus, hasn't paid its bills. Christine finds that working remotely with disabled children is particularly challenging.
The most difficult thing is that the therapist is not really in front of them. And there is something that is powerful about having a real person right next to you. So the children oftentimes are frustrated with remote learning.
What do we do on the Zoom? We just kind of chill.
Harold,
our neighbor. Where does Harold live?
Jack also misses seeing his therapist in person. As we sit on the stoop of their brownstone townhouse in Brooklyn, Laurie calls this moment in their lives beautiful chaos.
As a parent, what's most difficult for you?
Getting Jack online, you know, 3 to 4 times a day and making sure that all the devices are powered and the speaker and his talker and, you know, texting work saying, okay, I'm so sorry, I'm going to be 5 minutes late to that Zoom. And, you know, the doorbell ringing. It's just, it's mayhem.
Jack and Laurie hope he'll be back at school in person this fall, seeing his bus driver and his beloved teachers. Jack's waiting patiently, hoping to find the school bus schedule in the mailbox any day now.
What I want for Jack in September and what I want for Jack at all times is to be happy and safe.
Yeah. Laurie, the mother of Jack, ending that report from Laura Trevelyan. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. And don't forget, British Podcast Awards/vote. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.
This podcast is brought to you by Uma. If you're a small business owner, now more than ever, you understand the importance of being able to adapt so you can always be there for your customers. Uma Office is a cloud-based business phone service that gives small business owners the flexibility needed to run a business efficiently from anywhere. With features like mobile and desktop apps, a virtual receptionist, and call recording, you can do more for less. Uma Office starts at $19.95 per user per month with no contracts. To learn more, go to uma.com or call 833-TRY-OOMA.